Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, breaking news. Top Democrats Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer rushed to the White House to meet face-to-face with President Biden, signaling new urgency about party infighting just hours before a planned vote that could derail their agenda. I'll ask the number two Senate Democrat, Dick Durbin, if his party can avert political and economic disasters. Also tonight, the nation's top general undergoes another grilling up on Capitol Hill, once again contradicting President Biden on Afghanistan and testifying about the final days of the Trump presidency. General Mark Milley also revealing he doesn't regret talking to the journalist Bob Woodward. The peril author, standing by live, will discuss. And we're standing by also for a judge's ruling on whether to end Britney Spears' conservatorship after the pop star has spent 13 years under the control of her father. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room.
This is CNN Breaking News.
We begin with the breaking news. Top House and Senate Democrats making an 11th-hour trip to the White House as deepening divisions are pushing their party, Congress, and the nation to the brink of crisis. Ryan Nobles is standing by up on Capitol Hill where the clock is ticking toward a critical vote and a potential government shutdown. But first, let's go to our senior White House correspondent, Phil Mattingly. Phil, what are you learning about Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's talks with the president?
For a little bit more than an hour, it was originally scheduled to be a call between the three, something they've been doing almost on a daily basis over the course of the last week as this critical moment for the president's domestic agenda came to the forefront. However, they decided to do it in person, underscoring that this is a complicated moment given the fact there is a House vote scheduled for that bipartisan infrastructure bill tomorrow. And this reality, according to officials, it very clearly will not have the votes to pass. A big part of the discussion was what to do because of that reality. Would they pull the bill? Would they let the bill fail? How would they operate going forward? One thing is also clear. No matter what happens tomorrow, the negotiations on the president's dual-pronged agenda, that bipartisan proposal, plus another multi-trillion dollar economic and climate package, are going to continue. And I think that's something White House officials have made clear over the course of the last several hours. They feel like, not just with the meeting with the two leaders, but also a meeting with Senator Joe Manchin, meeting with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, in several hours of staff discussions behind closed doors with Sinema, those two critical moderates, that they have made progress, progress that could lay the groundwork for a potential deal going forward. However, what they lack at this moment and what there is no sign they are going to get is any type of concrete commitment from those senators, the exact thing progressives were looking for. And that means, at least at this point in time, they certainly won't have the votes for any package tomorrow, Wolf.
Yeah, it's a real crisis unfolding. I want you to stand by, Phil. I'm going to get back to you just in a couple of moments. I want to go to Capitol Hill right now. Our congressional correspondent Ryan Nobles is on the scene for us. Ryan, we just heard from one of the key players here, the West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. He's a Democrat. What's he saying now about tomorrow's planned infrastructure vote?
Well, Wolf, he put out a statement that was as emphatic as he has ever been throughout the course of these negotiations, insisting that he is not prepared to sign off on any agreement right now in a reconciliation package that spends what he called trillions of dollars. This is part of what his statement said. Quote, "While I am hopeful that common ground can be found that would result in another historic investment in our nation, I cannot and will not support trillions in spending or on an all-or-nothing approach that ignores the brutal fiscal reality our nation faces. There is a better way, and I believe we can find it if we are willing to continue to negotiate in good faith." And what that statement tells you is that Manchin is not ready to sign on to even the framework of an agreement that would allow progressives to vote yes on that bipartisan infrastructure bill that is scheduled for a vote tomorrow. In fact, we caught up with a progressive leader, Pramila Jayapal of Washington State. She is the leader of the Progressive Caucus. We asked her for her read on the Manchin statement, and this is what she said.
I can tell you that his statement has just probably created at least a bunch more votes on the House floor against a bipartisan bill.
So that's Jayapal saying that the Manchin statement allows her to corral even more progressives to hold firm and not vote yes tomorrow. So that leaves the ball in the court of the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. Will she delay this vote? Wolf, she just returned back here to Capitol Hill from the White House. She told reporters that as of right now, it is still the plan to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill tomorrow. The big question is, where will the votes come to make it happen? And we should also point out, Wolf, that these intense negotiations over the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the reconciliation package, they come amidst two big issues that the Congress still has to deal with. That's the funding of the government, which is scheduled to run out as soon as midnight on Thursday. And of course, the debt limit that's set to be exceeded by the middle of October. Right now behind me in the House chamber, they are voting on their portion of a bill that would suspend the debt limit through next year. It, of course, still needs to pass the Senate, where it faces a much more uncertain future, although lawmakers do believe they have the votes to make sure that government funding stays intact through the end of the week. Wolf.
So I just want to clarify, Ryan, Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, says the vote is still scheduled for tomorrow. It's a critically important vote, this bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that passed the Senate with all 50 Democrats and, 19 Republican senators voting for it. But she also says, even though she says the vote is scheduled for tomorrow, she's also said in recent days she would never let a bill come up for a vote on the House floor if she didn't think it was going to pass. So does she think it's still going to pass?
Yeah, I mean, that's the great question right now, Wolf. She just got back here to Capitol Hill and faced a gaggle of reporters, and she was specifically asked, is it still your plan to bring the bill to the floor tomorrow? And she said that was the plan without elaborating on how she plans on pulling together these votes. Remember, the Progressive Caucus has said in the past that more than half of their members, they have almost 100 members in the Progressive Caucus, so that would mean somewhere in the range of 45 to 50 progressives have said they're going to vote no. Her margins are much smaller than that in order to get this bill over the finish line, so it's not exactly clear where the speaker is going to come up with these votes, but at this point, she has no plans to postpone the vote.
Yeah, if 40 or 50 Democrats are going to vote against the infrastructure bill, then you're going to need 40 or 50 Republicans to vote in favor of it to offset that. Let's see what happens. Ryan, stay with us. Phil is over at the White House. He's staying with us as well. I want to bring in our chief political correspondent, Dana Bash. Dana, so what's your reaction to what we're hearing from the speaker, Nancy Pelosi, right now? This is a critical moment. You covered Congress for a long time. We've seen these moments before. What's your assessment?
That she is telling reporters just moments ago, as Ryan just reported to us, that the vote is still on tomorrow. That's the way to keep the pressure on, the way to keep the negotiations going, the way to keep the talks going, likely late into the night, early into tomorrow morning. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is a sure thing that this vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill will happen tomorrow if she doesn't have the votes. As you mentioned, Wolf, she has said before, why would I take something to the floor when I don't have the votes? But if she continues to say that that's the plan, it will make the urgency that we've already seen even more real. And so that's the reality. And the fact that she and the Senate Majority Leader went to the White House is a reminder of the fact that I know our team has been saying this, but I think it's worth repeating that these negotiations are among Democrats. This is a deal that they are trying to make within the president's own party. This is not the bipartisan deal and the bipartisan negotiation that the president as a candidate talked about. That has happened. It happened earlier on with this infrastructure bill. But right now what we're talking about is getting every Democrat in the Senate and enough Democrats in the House with a very, very slim margin there on board with whatever it is that they come up with, both on the social safety net, so-called reconciliation bill, and more importantly, well, on that, so that they can get agreement to vote for that bipartisan bill that passed the Senate over the summer.
You know, Dana, as you know, President Biden came into office promising that Congress could actually govern. But is his own party, the Democratic Party, now testing that premise?
Yes, it is. It's his own party testing the premise, but the reality of having literally not one vote to spare in the Senate, a 50-50 Senate, and not even a handful of votes to spare in the U.S. House, and the direction of the party and the direction of the country at stake for so many of these members who see this as their moment to use these issues and use this time and use that narrow margin as leverage. Joe Manchin and moderate Democrats in the Senate and the House have as much leverage as maybe even, well, as much leverage, I should say, as the progressives. This is the first time, if you look back, that we've also seen the progressives actually stand up in a block and say, this is our moment. We finally have a president, even though he is now considered a moderate, but is pushing more progressive ideas. If we don't do it now, when is it going to happen? And that is why they are each standing firm and trying to use every single second left, every single bit of negotiation to get what they can out of this. And it is the ultimate test for the president and for the House Speaker.
Yeah, it's a make or break moment that we're watching unfold today and tomorrow. All right, guys, stand by. We're going to get back to you. Also coming up, America's top general faces tough questions over his controversial actions during the final days of the Trump administration. I'll speak with the author of the book that ignited the firestorm, Bob Woodward. He's standing by live. We'll discuss when we come back. America's top general was back in the hot seat today as lawmakers pressed the nation's military leaders on the chaotic exit from Afghanistan and the controversial decisions made during the final days of the Trump administration. Our senior national security correspondent Alex Marquardt has more.
A blunt assessment from the nation's top general opening the second day of congressional hearings on the end of the war in Afghanistan.
It was a tactical, operational, and logistical success evacuating 124,000 people. The war was a strategic failure.
General Mark Milley making clear that after former President Donald Trump lost the election, he ordered an accelerated withdrawal of all U.S. troops before President Joe Biden took office, having already agreed with the Taliban to fully withdraw. It was a decision Milley says he was cut out of.
That's why I went over to the White House with Acting Secretary Miller and the White House Chief of Staff Kash Patel to discuss that order. So I wasn't consulted on it.
Republican lawmakers went after the apparent contradiction between the generals wanting 2,500 U.S. troops to stay and President Biden telling ABC News he didn't get that advice.
In January of this year, were you of the opinion in your professional military judgment that we should have maintained 2,500 troops, U.S. troops?
Yeah, my assessment that I read in the opening statement remained consistent. And
did that professional military opinion change over the course of the next few months?
Not until a presidential decision, and I rendered my opinions, and it was a fulsome debate on all of that. And once decisions are made, then I'm expected to execute lawful orders.
Milley was again attacked by Republicans for calls that he made to his Chinese counterpart in October and January. Milley said intelligence showed that the Chinese were worried about an American attack, so worried that the intelligence appeared in the president's daily brief and was shared with top national security officials.
That was significant, and there was a lot of it. It wasn't just a singular report. There was a lot. I'll be happy to share that with you and go over to you with you line by line.
According to the new book, Peril, Milley told the Chinese that the U.S. would not attack China. Today, he said those calls were meant to convey President Trump's intent.
I said, hell, General Lee, I'll probably give you a call, but we're not going to attack you. Trust me, we're not going to attack you. These are two great powers, and I am doing my best to transmit the president's intent, President Trump's intent.
Milley said he had no regrets about speaking with Peril co-author Bob Woodward, insisting that it's important to speak with the press.
I have done my best to remain personally apolitical and to try to keep the military out of actual domestic politics.
After repeated GOP calls for Milley to resign, Congresswoman Liz Cheney apologized to the general for her Republican colleagues.
For any American, to question your loyalty to our nation, to question your understanding of our Constitution, your loyalty to our Constitution, your recognition and understanding of the civilian chain of command is despicable.
Republicans have accused General Milley of going outside of the chain of command because of reporting in that book by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, which said that Milley told senior officers to make sure that he was involved in any potential launch of nuclear weapons by President Trump. Milley also confirmed that he did speak about that with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but insisted today that he didn't agree with her reported comments calling Trump crazy. He said that he wasn't qualified to assess anyone's mental health. Wolf.
Alex Marquardt reporting for us. Alex, thank you very, very much. I want to dig deeper right now with the journalist Bob Woodward. He's the co-author of the new book entitled, there's the cover, Peril, which was obviously on so many members' minds at today's hearing and yesterday's hearing. First of all, congratulations, Bob. I know it has just emerged as number one on the New York Times bestsellers
list.
Thank you. Not a surprise. All of your books are usually number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. But this is also causing a lot of news, creating a lot of news out there right now. Well, what was your reaction to General Milley, for example, today saying he has no regrets speaking to you in detail for the book Peril?
Well, that's his theory, and I happen to agree that it's very important that people be responsive. This is a long-term project that Bob Costa and I worked on, and we were able to get facts and documents and transcripts of the Milley Pelosi call, for instance, which tells you that he agreed with her assertion that that President Trump was acting crazy. He said today, well, look, I'm not qualified to determine if the mental condition of the President of the United States, but as we used to, in the old days, call that's a non-denial denial.
Well, let me ask you about that, because in his testimony yesterday and today, he said, as you correctly point out, he said, I'm not qualified to determine the former president's mental health. But in your book, Nancy Pelosi is quoted as saying, you got the transcript, he's crazy, and what he did yesterday is further evidence of his craziness. She's referring to Trump. Milley said, quote, Madam Speaker, I agree with you on everything.
Yes. Well, that was very well reported, and it is documented. And he's saying now, I don't know whether he's claiming he said to Pelosi or he just said, look, I'm not qualified to determine the mental capacity of a president of the United States,
he said,
which
today,
is true.
He said it's true. He said, I'm not a doctor. I can't testify about anyone's mental capability.
But he's not denying that he agreed with Pelosi a couple of times in that transcript.
That's significant. What do you make of the accusations by some of the Republican lawmakers that he spent way too much time talking to you and not enough time worrying about Afghanistan?
No, that's just not so. I mean, look, the obligation, I obviously salute this, of somebody in that position willing to talk. And it's not just, hey, here's a dump, but Costa and I had months and we check everything, and there are things that have come out since. For instance, that he had authority from higher-ups, which we had not confirmed and is not in the book, and we now know is true.
He also said, testified today, that a lot of officials knew about his conversations with the Chinese general, his counterpart, the Chinese general. And he also pointed out, I thought this was interesting, I don't know if you knew this, he said it was even included, that conversation, in the presidential daily brief.
I did not know that, but that would make sense. Look, this was a national security crisis for the country, and we did not know. He was handling it. Others were handling it. But tensions with the Chinese today are real and something that is being monitored very closely. In this period, the Chinese were on alert, as were the Iranians and the Russians.
So you think he did the right thing in that phone call?
I think he, everything that Bob Costa and I found showed that he was acting to protect the country. I mean, it's very alarming when you hear that a major adversary thinks you are going to attack them. This is the moment you get a response and you get something like Pearl Harbor, as history shows.
And as we heard, a very strong statement from Liz Cheney supporting, defending general's behavior. Hey, congratulations once again, Pearl.
Thank
number
you.
One on the New York Times bestseller.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Bob Woodward reporting for us. Coming up, with Democrats will Democrats avert a disastrous government shutdown and save President Biden's agenda in the final hours of negotiations? I'll ask the second-ranking Senate Democrat. The number two Democrat in the Senate, Senator Dick Durbin, is standing by live. Breaking news, the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, says she still plans to bring the bipartisan infrastructure plan to a vote tomorrow, despite members of her own party threatening to sink the entire bill. This, as moderate Senator Joe Manchin says he cannot and will not support the $3.5 trillion spending plan favored by progressives. The Senate Majority Whip, Senator Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, is joining us right now. Senator, thank you so much for joining us. So get your reaction to what we just heard in a statement released by Senator Manchin saying he cannot and will not, that's a quote, cannot and will not support the reconciliation bill. But the House Speaker says she'll still bring the infrastructure bill to the House floor tomorrow. Could this doom both of those bills, the 1.2 bipartisan infrastructure bill and the $3.5 trillion reconciliation budget package?
I think we've shown a lot of respect to our colleagues who obviously have a different point of view when it comes to reconciliation. There's been meaningful negotiation. It's gone on for weeks. The president has been involved personally. I've never seen a president engaged this way since Barack Obama's days with the Affordable Care Act. So we're all in, all aboard. Now it's time, I would say, for both senators, make your mark and close the deal. What is it that you want? What is your final goal? It's time to stop talking around it and speak directly to it.
Well, you're talking about Senator Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema.
Yes, I am.
You need both of their votes in a 50-50 Senate right now. If you lose one of them, it's over.
That's right. And I want to be very candid about that. That analysis is spot on. I don't know of any alternative to it. And everything is tied to it. The future of the bipartisan infrastructure bill is tied to it. I think future of the debt ceiling is tied to it. It is time for us to make a decision and do our job. I would say to both of them, their point of view is different than mine, but it's been respected, it's been negotiated, and now it's time to close the deal.
Senator Manchin in his statement says he might be open to this reconciliation bill, the $3.5 trillion package, by the end of the year. He says he's not ready to vote for it now. Why is it just sinking in that Manchin is clearly, at least for now, not on board?
Well, I tell you, Joe's made a number of statements. He's my friend. I respect him, and I've tried my best to sit down for a few minutes and talk to him about this. But I would say to him, we can't delay these things. Simply delaying them is just inviting a bad result, to be honest with you. You know, we are one heartbeat away from losing the majority in the United States Senate, and I've been in the Senate long enough to see that happen. So I would urge Joe, if you believe there's value and merit to the programs in the reconciliation bill, don't wait. Do it now.
Yeah, because in a statement that he released, and it's a very carefully drafted written statement, he says, I cannot and will not support trillions in spending or an all-or-nothing approach that ignores the brutal fiscal reality our nation faces. So clearly, he's not going to support it now. Maybe down the road, you guys can come up with some separate package. But what happens to the bipartisan $1.2 trillion basic infrastructure package that clearly the country needs?
Well, I wish Nancy Pelosi well. She has defied a lot of common belief and come through in the past when she's faced these challenges. And I'm not going to gainsay her situation now. I trust her and believe she's going to do the right thing. But I sincerely hope that we can pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill with the clear promise that the reconciliation bill is going to be passed as quickly as possible.
Yeah, because that bipartisan legislation, it passed overwhelmingly in the Senate. 19 Republicans, all 50 Democrats voted for it. Now it's up to the House of Representatives. Yeah, you get that or you might wind up getting nothing down the road. It's a real dilemma for you guys. The clock is also, if that were not enough, Senator, the clock is also ticking to avert a government shutdown. Does the Senate have the votes to keep the government funded, which would mean kicking the can down the road on the debt ceiling as well?
Well, with fingers crossed, we think we have an agreement for a vote tomorrow that's going to avert a government shutdown. This is a problem that should have been taken care of. Chuck Schumer went to the floor and said, let us do this with Democratic votes only, and we'll move forward, and Senator McConnell disagreed. So now tomorrow we're going to try to see if there is some common ground with a few amendment votes. I hope by the end of the day tomorrow we'll have that job done.
The deadline is midnight. Tomorrow night you guys got to pass that legislation before then. Senator, good luck. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Wolf.
Just ahead, we're getting the first word on a judge's ruling tonight on Britney Spears' battle to free her, from her father's control over her estate. We have breaking news on the next round of subpoenas in the January 6th committee's special investigation. Our law enforcement correspondent, Whitney Wild, is here in the Situation Room with details. Whitney, what are you learning?
Well, Wolf, the second round of subpoenas targets people who were affiliated with the Women for America First group. That is the group that held the permit for the Stop the Steal rally that we know ended up in that riot at the Capitol. This new list includes 11 people who were either involved with or somehow affiliated working with the America First, Women for America First organization. These people held a range of roles within this organization of the rally. And what the committee is really trying to do here is drill down on the coordination between the White House and Trump associates and the rally organizers. This next batch of subpoenas builds on the volumes of documents they've already requested. So the questions are, who was involved? Who were they talking to? What were the conversations? What was the goal? Again, they have already requested volumes of documents from the National Archives relating to the recruitment, the preparation, the coordination of these rallies leading up to and on January 6th that were part of this Stop the Steal movement set to try to overturn the election. The committee has already sent out subpoenas to four close allies of the former president, including Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows. Wolf, in some cases, the committee is just going straight to subpoenas because they're concerned that some of these witnesses are just not going to be willing to volunteer information. They say simply they don't have all day to wait around, so they're going right to subpoenas. They're trying to cut down on the time. They want to get these answers, and they want to get them quickly.
This House Select Committee is moving very quickly indeed, getting a lot of information. Whitney, thank you very, very much. I want to bring in our chief legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin. Jeffrey, the organizers of the Stop the Steal rally are key witnesses for this special committee. Explain what specific information they can offer.
Well, the most important information they can offer is who organized this rally and who authorized it and who knew and who planned the violence that came out of it. Obviously, there is nothing wrong with planning a rally near the White House with strong words spoken, but this turned into a riot. And the question is, who knew and who planned any sort of violence? But, you know, this is a very good and appropriate investigative step. But there are tools to respond, chiefly the Fifth Amendment. Several of these witnesses may say, I'm not cooperating because it implicates my right to self-incrimination. That will raise the question of whether the committee wants to give them immunity. That's a time-consuming process. Time is not on the side of this committee, whether it's the high-level officials, the four around Trump who were subpoenaed, who may claim executive privilege, the Fifth Amendment issue here. They want the committee wants to move quickly, but the witnesses have the opportunity to slow this down.
So they could clearly fight the subpoenas, I guess. Would they have any strong legal ground on which to stand?
Well, the Fifth Amendment is a strong legal ground. You can't be forced to testify if you take the Fifth. Now, that can be overcome if the committee gives immunity, but that is a time-consuming process. Anything that goes into the courts, even if you have a bad argument, can delay things. The four Trump associates who were subpoenaed first, they don't have a good legal argument, I think, to resist the subpoena, but they could go to court. And once you're in court, you have to go to district court. You have to go to the Court of Appeals. Someone could go file for certiorari. This is a very time-consuming process, and that's a problem that this committee faces since it's already October or it's almost October, before an election year.
We'll see what happens. All right, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you very, very much. There's more breaking news just ahead. Britney Spears' father is out as the conservator of her estate. We're going to have details on a judge's ruling just released and what it all could mean for the pop star's future. Breaking news on a life-changing moment for Britney Spears. A judge just suspended her father as the conservator of her estate. CNN Entertainment reporter Chloe Melas is joining us with details. Chloe, tell us more about this decision, what it means specifically for Britney Spears.
Well, this is exactly what Britney Spears wanted, Wolf. She wanted her father suspended. It's what her new attorney, Matthew Rosengart, said over and over for about 10 to 15 minutes in the courtroom. I was sitting there and he said, we don't want to terminate the conservatorship today. We want this to be orderly. We want this to be methodical. But the first order of business is to suspend her father, Jamie Spears, who's been the conservator of her estate for 13 years. Jamie Spears, on the other hand, didn't want this. Jamie Spears wanted it terminated. Well, Matthew Rosengart thinks it's because he didn't want to have to turn over files and all of this financial evidence that could be poured over by this new conservator. So the temporary conservator is a CPA by the name of John Zabel. I just want to read you a couple quotes that Matthew Rosengart said today. Britney Spears did not attend court virtually, but Matthew Rosengart spoke on her behalf. He said, my client Britney Spears deserves to wake up tomorrow without her father as her conservator. It is against her mental state of mind to have her father as her conservator for one more day. Also saying that her father is a continuing toxic, untenable presence in the life of Britney Spears. Well, no more. Britney will wake up tomorrow without her father as her conservator. She will go to bed tonight with someone else in charge of her finances. And there is another court date that's going to be set. So in about 30 to 45 days, we're going to see another court hearing where Judge Brenda Penny will most likely look at a plan in place, a financial plan and a care plan in place for Britney, and then terminate this conservatorship once and for all. So, Wolf, for all intents and purposes, by the new year, Britney, a free woman. But today, a huge day for Britney and the Free Britney movement that have been calling for Jamie Spears to be suspended.
It's a huge movement indeed. Chloe Melas, thank you very, very much. She's in Los Angeles for us. Let's get some analysis from our senior legal analyst, Laura Coates. So, Laura, what does Jamie Spears' suspension mean for Britney Spears' immediate future?
Well, it means that she has agency, at least in some respects, over the decisions in terms of her being able to decide who will make those decisions in tandem with her. And this is really a bigger story, as Chloe has spoken about for weeks now. It's really not only about the idea of the Free Britney Spears movement, but also about a larger discussion about conservatorship laws in general in this country. In fact, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday about this idea of allowing people to have some agency over the decisions they make. And normally, it's reserved for people who are incapable of being able to make certain determinations. It's not intended for people when you disagree with the choices that they might make, just because you disagree, as opposed to it being a reflection of a bigger issue. And so what you're seeing, this is very emblematic, frankly, about a shift in viewpoints about the conservatorship laws in this country and being allowed to have somebody have a say and a vocal one about her own future. And I'll note, this was the first time since this 13-year conservatorship actually began that Britney Spears had at least some semblance of ability to have somebody who is her personal advocate and champion by her own selection and choice.
So what are the next steps, Laura, for Britney Spears' legal team?
Well, now you're talking about, as Chloe mentioned, the idea of having a date certain in the future to then fully evaluate whether to end it entirely. It's one thing to have the conservator, who is the person who is going to be the vehicle by which decisions are made, financial, health-related, or otherwise. Now you'll have the potential end of it entirely and the complete turn of events to have her be the person in charge of her own life. Now, there is going to be some back and forth and some discussions among her own counsel about what a vision of some sort of safety net and guardrails that a conservatorship actually provides for people if they so choose to do so. But remember her very emotional pleas to the courts over the summer, discussions about wanting to have children, to remove a device from her body for contraceptive purposes, to be able to have more children. The idea of being able to choose the medication or at least lessen or have a different medicine regimen available to her. And the idea of being able to choose when she wants to perform and when she does not want to perform. So you're talking about an evaluation of all of those things, Wolf, with an eye towards trying to give this woman agency over her own life.
Laura Coates, with excellent analysis as usual. Thank you very, very much. Just ahead, U.S. Capitol Police say members of Congress are facing a record number of threats. What's behind this very disturbing surge? We have new details. We'll share them with you right after the break. Tonight, officials are sounding the alarm about a very disturbing trend up on Capitol Hill. Our Brian Todd is joining us right now. He's got details. Brian, what are you learning about these escalating threats to U.S. lawmakers?
Wolf, the predictions for the numbers of threats to members of Congress this year, predictions coming from the new Capitol Police Chief, are staggering. A year that began with the January 6th insurrection could well end with a record number of threats to lawmakers. U.S. Capitol Police Chief Tom Manger, in a new interview with the Associated Press, says, quote, "We have never had the level of threats against members of Congress that we're seeing today. Clearly, we've got a bigger job in terms of the protection aspect of our responsibilities." Manger predicted in the interview that authorities could respond to some 9,000 threats to members of Congress by the end of this year. He told Wolf in August that the number could be even higher.
We typically, just a couple years ago, had around six or 7,000. This year, I think we'll be up close to 10,000 threats that we're investigating.
The reasons for the rise in threats are varied. Domestic extremists have been buoyed by the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, by false claims of fraud in the 2020 election, by former President Donald Trump's incendiary rhetoric.
We did win this election.
But the ability of those who would do harm to find members of Congress has also changed.
Remember, your members of Congress are elected, you know, all the time. So they're always out on the campaign. They need to be known. They want to be known. People know who they are just by sight. They know where they live.
Democratic Congresswoman Norma Torres found that out in a frightening way. This summer, after she had a political dispute over Twitter with the president of El Salvador, she says she received multiple threats, then an anonymous video, a man's voice narrating it.
He stated that he was following me, and he panned out to a blue vehicle, which I had. I owned a blue SUV. And he said that he was following me and then panned down to his gun and said that he had something for me.
How frightened are you, though, still of all this?
I sold my car. I just could not drive that car.
Republican Congressman Tom Reed says someone left a dead rat and a brick on his doorstep, along with a family member's name. The Capitol Police don't have the resources for every member of Congress to get their own security detail in their home districts, so it's up to many of them to protect themselves. After that video incident, Congresswoman Torres says gang members cased her home in California and once tried to bait her husband out onto the street. So she retrieved a gun from their home and scared them off.
I went in and armed myself. I thought that they were going to come in and hurt, you know, not just my husband, but myself. So I'm going to do whatever I need to do to protect myself and my family.
Congresswoman Torres says after those incidents, Capitol Police did come to her home in California and guarded it for about a week. But she says they cannot provide constant security for her, and she doesn't want to hire her own security detail. And she says the threats have now followed her to Washington. So she recently moved out of her basement apartment here in D.C. to a more secure building. Wolf, this lady's gone through quite a lot.
Yeah, this is so, so disturbing. All right, Brian, thank you very much for that report. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. You can always follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Wolf Blitzer. You can tweet the show at CNN Sit Room. And the Situation Room is also available in podcast form. Look for us on CNN.com/audio or wherever you get your podcasts. Aaron Burnett Out Front starts right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.